Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Daniel Burke, not Bork, and he is the creator of a YouTube channel that has over 100,000 subscribers on the crossover between health, technology, and art. But he is also an AI data scientist who is a machine learning and deep learning coder. So a very brilliant, smart individual we're dealing with here. And Daniel's actually somebody who, when I first started the podcast, before I even had produced one episode, he was like, I'm down to come on this podcast. And we recorded one episode when the actual podcast first began, but now we're recording when we've recorded another one here. And it's cool because Daniel's up to some really interesting things. He has a food website app that is currently just something in his head, but it is hopefully going to turn into something real in the next coming year. He worked on a farm, and he just has insightful ideas on life. And so Daniel is definitely someone who's pursuing the highest version of himself. I wanted to highlight him here, and hopefully this conversation made you think a little bit, made you interested, made you curious about life itself, as it did for me. And so just a little disclaimer and warning, the audio on Daniel's side, we touched it up a little bit. I actually sent it to Daniel and he helped make it better. He's that machine learning AI genius that he is. But we touched up. There's still issues with it, but hopefully those get edited out in post-production. But, you know, other than that, I think this was a beautiful experience, and hopefully it comes across that way for you as well. And so, without further ado, here is Daniel Burke.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Daniel Burke, the legend, second appearance on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. What's your headspace like going into this podcast?
I hate to start this by correcting you, but it's Burke and not Bork, but that's okay.
Oh man.
That was out of niceness, not out of malice. So I couldn't go the whole podcast with leaving that. It's like when you have a booger on your nose and someone doesn't, like you go like 3 hours with it on your nose and no one tells you. It's like, oh, it would have been better if you just told me. What's going on in my headspace? Dude. A fair amount of things. It's that time of year, I'm not sure when this is coming out, but it's leading up into Christmas and New Year. And you could say this at any time of year, but it's that time of year where it's just, you got events on all the time. Like there's Christmas parties, there's breakups, there's New Year's, my dad's birthday. It's amazing. My brother and I are trying to buy a house. I've got a book that I'm trying to get printed. I'm working on a new course. Probably too many things going on, actually. But that's all right. That's all right. That's what variety is, the spice of life. I'm working on a farm one day a week. That's really fun. I've got to get my second shot of the COVID vaccine. There's a lot of things going on, man.
Dude, it's wild hearing you talk about so many things, and it's exactly what I would expect knowing and seeing you online, because it seems like your hands are in a bunch of different places. But what's exciting you the most out of all those things? Let's start there.
Exciting me the most would be the new project, machine learning project that I'm working on, or have started with my brother, that I've been wanting to work on for a while. And I'm sort of like, the fun part about it is so backstory, I'm a machine learning engineer, which is a computer programmer that writes machine learning algorithms to learn about the world. So you might have heard of GPT-3 or something like that. So GPT-3 was to do with language from OpenAI. I prefer my sort of style is vision, so computer vision, like the algorithms that help to drive a Tesla self-driving car. So the project that me and my brother have started is called Nutrify. The motto is take a photo of food and learn about it. And so that's sort of culminating or combining my interests for food and nutrition with being a tech nerd. So before I was a machine learning engineer, computer programmer, I studied food science and nutrition. So I've got a soft spot for food. I mean, I think everyone loves food. It'd be strange if you didn't. But so that's what's taking up a lot of my headspace. So basically all of the research that I'm doing at the moment is kind of, I'm kind of looking at a world through that lens at the moment. When I walk through a shopping center, I'm like, or when I cook food, I'm like, how would the algorithm decipher what's on this plate of food? And so I'm thinking about that kind of constantly. So that's kind of taken over my worldview at the moment. And then there's, of course, a few other things that are very exciting. That is probably number one. Number two is that the physical copy, I got some pilot copies of my my book arrived from a printer. So I wrote a novel, published a digital version at the start of September 2021, which is all self-published. And so I got to figure out how you print a lot of books, which it turns out in the current state of the world with COVID and whatnot, there's a lot of shortages on everything, including paper. And if you're not a big publishing company, which I'm not, and you don't want to print 20,000 books, it's quite hard to get a small run of print at larger printers. And so I'm currently partnering with someone from North Carolina, actually. Shout out to Saya. And we're looking at getting some hardcover, some beautiful hardcover linen color cover books at the start of February. But I'm also partnering with another printing company and trying to get about 500 or so paperbacks by the end of the year. But we'll see. So those are the two things that are exciting me the most.
Is the food thing you're doing with your brother an app? Is it a website? How are you guys?
Yeah.
Or is it just for fun? Like, what will it be?
So right now it's just for fun, but I'm taking it seriously. So it's going to be the project that I'm going to work on for all of 2022. Just see how far it goes for a year. I make videos on YouTube, so I'm going to be making videos about that along the way. Just sort of like figuring out how to build it, because the exciting part for me is we said at the start, like before we started recording, is the exciting thing about NFT space is you don't know what's going to come. It's exciting, but you don't know what's out there. So the same thing for this is like I have this like pie in the sky vision of like what I would like it to ideally look like, but all those steps that lead towards that, I have no idea how to do. So the fun part is I get to figure it out on the way, and will it work? I don't know. It's something I'd like to use.
What
it would be, and right now it's a website. You can go to Nutrify.app. Pie in the sky vision is you can take a photo of any food and it will tell you what's like information about it. The information could be nutrition, origin, how to make it, when did that food come into existence. So, for example, coffee like is sort of like it's one of the most researched foods in the world, but it's only existed in sort of society and communities for the last 300-400 years. So, I mean, people consume it every day, but it'd be cool to know that information and just geek out on why does coffee make you feel how it makes you feel? And then you could add infinitum that for any food. So the pie in the sky, where I'd like it to be by the end of next year is before New Year's this year, it will do 100 foods. And then the end of next year will be 1,000. And then after that we'll just keep do the tail from that. So, and when I say food, I also mean like you just have a plate of food and take a photo of it. I like that interactive level. Of course, you can already just Google what's on your plate, but that's no fun. It'd be way cooler if you could just snap a photo of something. And then the same thing with text-based model. So as in, if you're in the, I find myself, I've done a nutrition degree and I go to the supermarket and I'll read a package of food and there'll be like an ingredients list as long as my arm. And I've never heard of half of the words on there. So the text-based version of the computer vision model will tell you, oh, what's preservative 202? Like, that's just numbers. What's the deal with that? So that's the grand pie in the sky. Walk through a supermarket, walk through a restaurant or whatever, and just take a photo of whatever you want, and you'll learn about it.
How'd you guys get this idea?
Good question. I think it was just, that's a fun thing to think about, actually, is now how prevalent cameras are. So I feel like it was just a culmination of like my background in food science and nutrition and just liking food, and then learning about machine learning and what that's capable of, and then going, hey, how can I combine these two? And not really even thinking it that way, like, how can I combine these two? It was just sort of, once I had the mental model of understanding food science and nutrition, and then I had the mental model of understanding how machine learning works, they kind of just congealed with each other. And so now I'm using the combined mental model to go, okay, this is the thing that I'd like to exist. And so I'm going to try and build it and put it all out online and make the code open source and whatnot so that people can see how it's done.
It's fascinating, right? Because you have this idea, you follow this idea, and we don't think often about the amount of time that it'll take to actually execute on the idea, but just the pure vision of it compels us forward. It's just an interesting thing to think about. And I'm excited to see how this plays out.
Yeah, well, when we do the third episode of this at the sometime at the end of 2022, I think there'll be, look, timeline-wise, I don't know, but there'll be a fair bit of progress. So it's like I'm terrible at estimating timelines. I kind of know where I want to go, but usually things take three times as long as you think. So,
speaking about timelines, you just hit 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. Congratulations on that. And I know you're not one to celebrate the numbers or really care about the numbers all too much, but how do you fathom 100,000 people? And speaking about timelines, when did you expect to hit 100,000 subscribers when you first started your YouTube journey?
Wow. So I think I posted my first video in the back end of 2016. It was just me and a friend. We dug a hole in my backyard at the time and built a pull-up bar. And it was wonky, and the video was called How Not to Build a Pull-Up Bar, which is still on my channel. But yeah, 100,000 is, I can't fathom it. It's that's a lot of people, like, right? So you go to a local cafe, you go to a restaurant, what, you're interacting with maybe 10 people. And then sometimes if it's really busy, there's 50 to 100. A shopping center at any given point might have like 2 to 3,000 people total in there. My high school, like, is probably one of the biggest reference points that I had like 1,000 students, and we would sit in assembly. So to think, like, that's 100 times that. And then in 200 plus countries around the world, and I couldn't even name 200 countries. So yeah, it's just, you can't fathom it. I can't fathom it. It's wild. And in terms of timeline of when I expected to, like, truth be told, like, I never really, and what you said about the numbers is right. I say that I don't care, but that's not to say that I don't care about the individuals. I say from my perspective, I'm not aiming for any particular number, right? It's like, I don't, like, it's, when I first started, I was like, 1,000 is good. 1,000 would be crazy because that's like 0 to 1,000 true fans and whatnot. I've still got a live stream on my channel of celebrating 1,000 subscribers. So that was fun to watch in comparison of the 100,000 live stream that I did. So yeah, I think, like, it kind of went in bursts. So, like, there'd be, for the last year or so as well, I kind of wasn't really going, I wasn't putting 100% effort into YouTube because I was working on other things. So it kind of just, the algorithm machine of like my past videos just kept moving. And so you can kind of map it out and think like when about like you're going to hit there if the trend keeps continuing. Sometimes it goes in bursts. If I post a video and the algorithm loves it and people love it, like you'll get heaps in one hit. And then, yeah, you never really pick it. But timeline-wise, I didn't really think about that. Like even now that I hit 100K, I'm like, oh, well, what's the next milestone? And it might be a million. It might be 200,000. And it's like, I've kind of, this is what I've noticed actually. When I started posting almost every week, in 2017, it was kind of like a doubling every year. So, or some years were like 4X. So I remember like at the end of 2018, I think it was 10,000. And then by the end of 2019, it was like 24,000. And then it was 60,000. And now it's 100,000 by the end of 20. I don't know. There's a timeline there, but, yeah, it's good fun. I'm going to, so 2022, there's going to be a lot more videos. So I've got a lot of ideas and they're going to come out then. So
how do you look back at the video of you, the 1,000 subscriber live stream? You said you watched that one. How do you notice the difference between you and that person back then?
Oh, that's fun. I think one of the things you can notice like immediately is, I noticed immediately is like the innocence. It's like, oh, look, this is younger me. Like who was just like had no, like, and it's, I feel like now I'm more of a, like you just learn to know yourself better. And of course, like that's constantly evolving over time. Now I feel like I've got more like confidence in who I am and like what like my values are. Of course I did back then. But it was a lot, the energy was very raw. Like I could tell back then it's still like that now, but it was sort of like, I remember just watching it like, whoa, no wonder people were like commenting on the videos. Like you've got so much energy and all that sort of stuff. It's like, I don't know. Maybe I was dosed up on caffeine when I was recording these videos. So, no, it was, so I can, the spirit is still the same. Like I was having fun. That's the main point. Like that hasn't changed throughout the entire thing. Like I don't post anything if I can't make it fun. So that stayed the same, but the innocence factor, like that was pretty cool to see.
Have you heard of Joe Delaney? He's a fitness YouTuber.
Joe Delaney. I probably have. I watch a fair few fitness guys, but the name rings a bell, but I can't draw a face.
He came on the podcast and he said something surprisingly similar about his own journey and particularly about the caffeinated part. Yeah, look him up. See if it rings any bells. He was talking about how when he looks back at the old videos of himself, there's a level of just excitement and rawness that he still has to this day, but it's a lot more subdued. And it's just very interesting to hear you say something very similar. And we never, as a human society, have had the ability to look back at old videos of us. How weird is that? You are part of really the first generation ever to be able to witness yourself in a not too distant past. That's crazy, right?
It's like, crazy.
Do you think about that?
I do. I thought about this probably for a whole day the other day in terms of like recorded audio as well. What we're doing right now is only like that was 1880 or something, 1870. I can't remember the exact date. So that's, let's say, 150 years. Before then, no one, if you wanted to listen to something, it would be played live. So the only people who would listen to music on their own were musicians. And now we can play whatever song we want, whenever we want. We can look up old conversations from whenever audio started to really get recorded. And similar with the camera. Like the camera, I don't know the exact date, but let's just say 150 years ballpark. It's funny, like you talk to you, if you, I'm not sure about like your grandparents and whatnot, but I talk to my granddad, I'll go see them and I see a photo of them when they were young and they have like one or two photos of their entire life. And it's like, it's a real serious day. They're all dressed up nice. And it's like, all the faces are like serious and whatnot. Like they're like, it's this big special day. There's a photographer here. And then like our generation, like I could search my name in my photos app and maybe there's 20,000 photos of me since I've owned an iPhone or something like that. And so like by the time I'm a grandparent and showing my children, it's like, well, I look at one photo of my grandfather and it's like, well, I'm going to show my grandchildren eventually. It's like, hey, you want to see the last million photos of my entire life? And so, and yeah. Not to mention video. I don't know. Like, it's crazy. It's a culmination, the internet. I mean, that's to grow up with the internet is kind of like, I talked to my dad and this is a funny contrast. Like my dad, never learned to even use a computer. Let alone the internet. So he was a school teacher and he owns a mobile phone now, but it's basically like non-existent, basically doesn't use it. It's always flat and, like you never call him on it. You call mum if you want to speak to dad. So there's like just that, that's just one generation gap, compared to whereas me, my entire life revolves around screens and the internet. Like majority of my day is connected to the internet in some way, shape or form. I make videos, which same thing with my dad, probably never almost, he's got a few more photos than my grandfather, but probably I've seen maybe 100 photos of him from the time he was born to the time now. So it's wild.
What do you, speaking about the photos particularly, in the videos that they were once very scarce and that it was a once in a every 10 years sort of occasion. And today photos and videos are all around us. We take them. They're abundant. What today is scarce that you believe will be abundant in the future?
Oh, I think I'm biased because I've been spending time on a farm, but I think small scale community based farms are quite scarce at the moment, but will gain more prevalence as years go on. So they're kind of doing like a backflip on the farming industry because that's how it would have started, smaller scale stuff. And of course, this is biased because I've been spending time on a local farm. But you just got to draw a line in terms of how the world perceives things like factory farming. Humans need food to exist. So that's a big player. Like that trend isn't going away anytime soon. And so I think as more and more people start to learn about or become health conscious and whatnot, that want better, that, like it all roads lead to having high quality food. So rather than, and soil, right? You need top quality soil to grow high quality food. And things like these big monocrops that grow just one single thing and use abundance of fertilizer and whatnot, damage the soil. So if we want to fix that in a certain way, we need to kind of go back to where farming sort of evolved. And cultivate the land in such a way that we're not destroying it. Work with nature rather than against it. So, of course, that's biased by what my time has been spent on, but it's also backed up by the fact that, as I said before, like humans need food to exist. And so that food might as well be high-quality food. So I think at the moment that's kind of scarce. Like, and this is what I'm thinking. I'm working on a farm at the moment, because I didn't like, I don't like the disconnect between what arrives on my plate and how it got there. So within a couple of hours of being on the farm the last few weeks, or the first time, I saw a half a dozen foods growing that I never knew how they grew. Like garlic, for example. I'd never seen a garlic plant in real life. And then was like amaranth, I'd seen kale and whatnot. But there's just these things like within, like literally within walking and like looking at this beautiful landscape of just all the different colors. And you just feel the, it's like looking, I described it to a friend who was working there. It was like, it's like looking at a newborn baby. It's like you get that feeling where it's, you cannot, words would do it an injustice to describe. It's this beautiful ecology, everything working in synchronicity with each other. And so, scarce wise, I think that's kind of across the board. If I'm a food nerd and I don't have an idea of when I go to the supermarket of how, or a local market of how something grows, and how it ends up on my plate, well, then I think a fair few other people are going to be quite similar. So yeah, that's probably the first thing that comes to mind in terms of scarcity, that will be abundant in the future. Well, I'd like it to be abundant.
I think that's a great take, and it's interesting the connection between the food app you're creating and learning how food is created. It's like a real nice connection there. Was that intentional or just happened?
Well, yeah, so you're totally right. If I was really elaborate with what the master plan is, it's top down, bottom up. So top-down approach is Nutrify. So have that accessible to everyone with a smartphone or a web browser, because it'll just run the same code. And that way that people can educate themselves from a top-down approach. There's no barriers to entry there. It's like you just go to a website, Nutrify.app. It's very primitive at the moment, but who knows, by the time we do episode 3, it'll look very nice. That's people can educate themselves through that. And that's something I would like to personally use. And then the bottom up approach is I'm spending time on a farm doing things that aren't scalable. Like I spent the last 4 or 5 years using a computer for my business, and it's very different. Like what actually goes on in a farm. So I figured, hey, if I'm going to be getting involved in this, if this is where I'd like my life to go, I need to have skin in the game and actually be spending time on the ground, digging things with my hands, harvesting things, talking to local growers, talking to local restaurants, and figuring out what that ecosystem looks like. And so the bottom-up approach is getting experience on land, maintaining a piece of land. In a couple of years, I'll be purchasing some acreage to create my own farm of sorts. Again, what that looks like, I don't entirely know. Where the land's going to be, I don't entirely know. But this is why I'm going to a farm to look to go, okay, I have a kind of idea now of what this requires, so I can start from there. So the bottom-up approach is literally from the ground up. And then the top-down approach, it's funny. It's like the analogy is like you can download it from the cloud. So it's, and then they'll be in the middle at some point. Who knows what that'll be. But that's the top-down, bottom-up approach of the war on food. No, I can't call it that. It's more an experiment.
I love it. And so take me through how you got this job on a farm. Like, that's a pretty rare thing to do, Daniel. Like, it's not like people are just going around and like, I've never worked on a farm. I don't know what's good with these farms. I want to learn and I want a job here. I mean, does that happen all the time? I don't know. I've never considered it, but it's definitely getting me thinking. And so what has been the process of getting that job? And then like, what have you learned? You mentioned briefly, but I'm excited for you to go deeper on it.
Yeah, well, so I've only spent 3 days there because it's 1 day a week, and I literally only started 3 days a week. I mean, sorry, 3 weeks ago, but I'm doing 1 day a week for the rest of summer, and Australian summer started yesterday. So I'm going to be doing at least the next 3 to 4 months there. That's what I've said to them in the beginning. But I literally just, so I started reading some books on soil, and I started getting obsessed with soil, because I figured, like, it's like, I'm all for, like, I'm a tech nerd, so I'm all for things like SpaceX and going to Mars and all those new technologies and whatnot. But if we can't grow food here, it does not matter what technologies that we create if we can't feed people on Earth. There will be no people to invent such technologies. So, like, it's like, I think, like, if you go back to first principles thinking, what do humans need? Like, sleep, food, water, loving relationships, shelter, etc. Like, whatever, you could keep going, make your own list. But food is pretty damn fundamental. So, how did I go to the farm? Started getting obsessed with soil and was reading a bunch of books on soil. And so I would just talk to people, like, I'd go to events and I'd be like, hey, I've been getting obsessed with soil lately. I just literally start conversations. You ever, like, looked about? And you get the exact same reaction. Like, people look at me like, is this guy for real? Like, he's, like, really excited about dirt. And I'm like, you're like, yeah. Like, there's a difference between soil and dirt. Like, dirt is death. Like, it's like you pick it up and just crumbles in your hand. Soil, you pick up soil, and I'm telling you, it is like looking at a newborn baby when it's like a fully living ecosystem. It's like staring out at the stars at a really dark night when it's like you can see all the stars, and there's something inside you, deep inside you, you just know, like, that it's such a beautiful ecosystem. Like, you're part of that ecosystem. Same with looking at a handful of rich soil with worms growing through it and minerals and whatnot. Like, it stays together in your head, whereas dirt just crumbles. So I was legit reading books on soil, and I'm like, well, this is, I can't just be book smart. I can't, like, just read about this stuff. I need to figure out how to put this knowledge into, like, it's totally, you could read all the books you want on soil and go out to the farm and be totally different. So, I was talking about that. And then it turns out one of my close friends, I hadn't seen in a while. We were at a party together, and it just coincided that he was studying regenerative agriculture, which is the process of, if you go to a piece of barren land. And so this is the thing, right? It's like, what could be more exciting than go to a piece? This is what the idea of terraforming Mars is. If we can't terraform Earth, well, how are we going to terraform Mars? So the idea of regenerative agriculture is to go to a piece of barren land, like, and people say that you can't grow anything, and to turn that, to use, to work with nature to get that back to full vibrancy. So how that looks going to be totally dependent on the land. You might have plants and you might have livestock, and then you might be rotating the plants and livestock so that the livestock, the cattle and whatnot, they piss and shit all over the ground, but that is actually fertilizer. Chickens might eat all the scraps of the food scraps. So it's like this beautiful synergistic system that all works. It's more than the sum of its parts. Like, it's a gestaltism. So he was studying regenerative ag, and I'm like, well, dude, I've been reading all these books on soil, and it's really fascinating me. We're vibing over this guy, Joel Salatin, who's this farmer in the US. He's been on Joe Rogan a few times. He's got some great, great outlooks on everything. And he's like, well, I'm going to work at this farm at Sanford, which is, so I live in Brisbane, which is like 20 minutes from where I live. And he's like, I'm doing an internship there over summer. And I'm like, oh, sweet. I'm going to email them and say, hey, I'll put my hand up and come volunteer for a day a week, because I run my own business, so I can kind of flexibly design my schedule. And plus, I'm like, if I'm really being serious about getting into the game of bottom up, top down, it's like, I can't just sit around and read books all the time. I need to get out onto the field. And so I just sent him an email like, hey, I'd like to come out a day a week over summer. Is that all good? And they're like, yeah, sure. Do you want to come out next week? And I was like, well, I've got something on next week on that particular day, but I can do the week after and then every week after that. And they're like, okay, see you then. And so I went out there and, got a tour of the land as I arrived. And it was like, wow, this is what's up. The first day was garlic harvest. So that's a real special day. garlic takes 6, 7, 8, 9 months, depending on when you plant it, what the conditions are, to grow. I'd never seen a full-blown blooming garlic plant in my life. I'd obviously bought garlic how you buy it from the store, but I'd never seen rows and rows of it in like ready to go. So they create this beautiful purple flower at the top, and the flowers, of course, smell like a weak garlic smell. And then you can use the flowers as a garnish. I've got some of them down in my kitchen now. They look beautiful. If you don't put them in water, they'll last a year, I'm told. So we'll see.
Dude, you are such a Renaissance man. It's so crazy, right? Because you're this YouTuber who does tech, deep tech, and you're machine learning, and you're in technology. But then you're also writing novels and imagining with the soil and coming together with it. It's the funniest thing. It's wild and a good reminder about how multidimensional we all are and have the potential to be if we don't box ourselves in. And my question to you is, what was the spark that got you interested in soil?
Well, it's probably a combination of, I remember a few exact moments of just reading and learning online. Like, there's been a few, like, I can't remember the exact, maybe it was someone sent me a clip of, what was the first moment? I can't remember the first moment. I think it's just been So I studied food science and nutrition at university, but then as I kept learning more and more about health, I learned, if we go back to first principles thinking, what the food science that I was learning was like how to manufacture food and make it in abundance once it's already been produced. And then so you can pack supermarket shelves with, that's what a lot of food science today is dedicated towards. Is my whole food science module was like basically how to design food factories to be bacteria free and pump supermarkets full of packaged food. And then so I'm like, hold on, this is kind of backwards. As I learned more and more of like actual nutrition and how food interacts with the body and whatnot, I'm like, let's go back to the root cause. Like, this is sort of putting a band-aid on things. Like, we're creating problems where there aren't problems. We're creating solutions. Like, it's the same as what pharmacy companies do. It's they invent a disease to make a drug for, rather than making a drug for a disease that already exists. So I'm like, I want to, let's keep going back steps. So the thing that you do when you're engineering, when you're coding something, you might have this full-blown application, but you take steps and steps. So the engineering thinking is to go right back to the foundation. Your bridge won't stay up if the foundations are rotten. So all roads lead back to soil. Like, it literally, like food, like there's all the food that we consume today at some point had to come out of the ground. That's another funny thing to think about, actually, is like everything you interact with came out of the ground at some point. So I'm like, okay, well, I need to start learning about
that's where we're all headed.
Things rather than just, you're right, exactly, circle of life. The Lion King was right. So we needed to, I figured out that it's like, well, all of this stuff that I'm learning is all influenced by how good the soil quality is. Like, it's literally the foundation, the bedrock of everything. And so that if you go down that rabbit hole, you start to, I was talking to my friends about this, and then they were sending me like videos of like clips of podcasts of like people who are far more knowledgeable about these things than I am. And you just start to realize it's like, wow, a lot of the practices that we're doing are like fucking up the land, are fucking up the soil, like are turning it. This is why like you hear like there's so many floods now, because when you soil versus dirt, soil holds water. Like, you can feel the moisture in it. Dirt, which is a non-living ecosystem, which just crumbles in your hand, like water just runs off the top of that. So then that's why there's floods. Like, the water doesn't get held in the ground. And this is another thing you could probably think about is, or I've thought about as well, is a lot of companies these days, are like big tech companies, are trying to do carbon offsets. I don't know the exact figures, but soil, when it's healthy, holds a significant amount of carbon dioxide. So people always think about trees and forests holding carbon dioxide. Most of that carbon dioxide is held in the fertile soil, so in the ground. So one potentially business avenue, it's to link up large tech companies or companies that make a lot of money. Because when I was on this farm, they do a lot of stuff with barely any like resources. Like farms aren't a lucrative business, especially small scale ones. So big technology companies, they want a carbon offset. How about they start looking into regenerating land and making the soil, because the soil is going to hold, I wish I had the exact numbers, but it is a very large amount of carbon gets deposited in high quality soil. And so potentially that's an avenue for this circle of life to come in, like work with nature rather than against it. And so I was just learning more and more about how the practice of how we farm today, especially in the US, Australia is quite similar to the US in terms of what we do. But basically, there's a closed loop system that big companies like Monsanto and Bayer have. Did you know, like 90% of the world's seeds come from one company? And that's kind of fucking crazy to think about. Is 90%? Again, these figures might only me regurgitating them from other people saying them, what I've heard. But let's just say a very significant amount of seeds come from one company, which is now Bayer, who bought Monsanto, who makes the fertilizer Roundup and glyphosate, which is one of the most used. And so the fertilizer companies control the seeds, and they modify the seeds to work with their fertilizers. And then if you're a farmer, you have to buy this. You have basically no choice but to buy these seeds from large company, who then will also sell you the fertilizer. And the fertilizer that you put on it, I mean, let's call a spade a spade. Fertilizer is a form of poison. And so, without getting like too conspiracy theory or whatnot, you just have to think about it. Like, would you drink that shit? Would you go to a hardware store and drink a bottle of Roundup? Because that's basically what you're doing when you spray like these fertilizers on huge mega crops. And then that stuff, like that nature didn't evolve fertilizer. And so when you mix, like, nature doesn't really like when humans mix the balance of things too much. And so when there's too much of one thing, I think it's maybe nitrogen and whatnot, it goes into the soil. Let's just say it doesn't like that. And so it ends up dying. Not only do you kill the weeds, you kill the soil. And once you kill the soil, you can't grow anything. And so if we run out of soil, we run out of food. That's a pretty big disaster. Like, if COVID-19 was pretty full on, like, imagine if we actually had a food, like a proper food shortage, like we can't grow food. That would be pretty chaotic.
What is vertical farming have to do with this, if at all? Have you looked into that? Could you educate me on that if you know anything about it?
No, I don't know enough about I don't know enough about farming in general. When I say all these things, by the way, like I'm coming at this from a very amateur, like, clearly I'm animated about it, but don't mistake that for knowing, having a deep knowledge of it. I'm still getting started in this. That's what a lot of, like, you can take for granted that it's sort of like people who are like me, who kind of can just throw their hands around and talk a lot, kind of sound like they know what they're doing, but I am very much still new to this game. I'll probably know a lot more over the next couple of years. But vertical farming, I haven't done enough research. For me, I'm kind of old school in a lot of different things. It's like, vertical farming to me seems, if you dedicated that same effort into trying to get a vertical farm to work into, like getting an actual piece of land to work, like, you probably, maybe in the beginning, you wouldn't have as much yield and whatnot, but over time, like, that curve would catch up to, it would be slow growing, because that's literally what it takes to sort of regen, like, a piece of barren land is it's a long process. It's not like what we're used to in the technology space of things like just exploding overnight. It does take three, four, five, six, seven, 8 years to like go from zero to like having a growable piece of land. So yeah, don't know enough about vertical farming, but from me, my perspective, I'd rather dedicate that effort into an actual piece of land.
That makes sense. And it's interesting because you are, it's so fascinating. You're dedicating all this time and energy to this one specific area. But I want to talk about another area you've dedicated a lot of time, which is so in the other direction, which is Charlie Walks. Dude, I mean, can you tie together those two things? Like, what is the connection?
Yeah.
Curiosity? Creativity?
Well,
like, what is the connection between?
Yeah. So Charlie Walks is my first novel, and that's come out a few months ago, the digital version, but now the print version is going to be out soon. If you wanted like a way to describe it in a couple of sentences, it's a coming of age story, and it's also, I've realized this is after writing it though, it's a getting back to nature story, which is kind of like the arc of my, of where I am at the moment. It's getting back to nature. So the whole idea of Charlie Walks is that he's a computer programmer at the world's largest technology company, which is unnamed in the book. That's a fun part about the book. No one has a last name, and it's a novel. It's like you imagine these things. That's the art of it. But he wants to be a writer. And so during the evenings, he writes letters to his nephew, Paulie, about stories from his life and stories from Sengen or XK1. You don't know that it's Sengen until later in the book. XK1, which is his secret project, which is a scenario generation machine, which creates the things that you need to see but can't imagine by connecting to your brain, and you can imagine how it does that. But if you see the front cover, I'll grab a copy. I'll get the front cover. 1 second. This is live. I should have had this ready, but this is all right. Wasn't too much of a break. So this is the front cover. If you look closely to it, on the left side is nature and on the right side is city. So, and Charlie's walking in between the two. So the fun word that I used on the back cover in the blurb is Charlie's a funambulist, a tightrope walker, walking between head and heart, between city and nature, between a good path and a real path, a known path and his own, between being a hider and a seeker, between life and death, living and dying, one option and another, another, another. So funambulist is a fun techno jargon word for tightrope walker. So Charlie is, the tightrope is between city and nature, but between almost every dichotomy you can think of. So he's a programmer at the largest technology company in the world, but starts to realize, like, hey, I've bought into this narrative that isn't necessarily aligned with where I'd like to go. It's not the wrong narrative, but for like people in general, but it is the wrong narrative for him. So, and of course, Charlie's based on me, like it's published as a work of fiction, but, like Charles Bukowski has Henry Chernowsky, who's like his alter ego. So I would say like the Charlie Walks is kind of, I started writing this at the back end of 2017, which is when I also started making YouTube videos quite consistently. So I would say it's kind of just the culmination of the last 4 to 5 years. And even before then, of like where my thought patterns have been going. So I when I was getting into technology, I bought into like the Silicon Valley narrative, like, yeah, let's go make a huge big company and go Google and Facebook and go to everywhere and whatnot and do that. But then I realized, hey, no, that's not really my style. I prefer a more chilled out way of doing things. Like to me, like a lot of the West tries to conquer nature. And this is I'm going to sound a bit hippie, but it's like the Western philosophy tries to conquer nature. We invent the bulldozer and the rocket ship to both clear out nature and take control of it with the bulldozer. And we invent the rocket ship to get away from it. Whereas Eastern philosophy, so Chinese, Hindu sort of point of view, is working with it. So West sort of thinks of time as a line, like you have a start and a finish, whereas East is more like of a circle, like the circle of life. Everything is involved with everything. So it's the Chinese doctrine of like the universe as an organism, each part, or Taoism, more, this is probably more Taoism, more everything interdependent on itself. So you can't, on itself and other things. So like the human body, you can't just separate the stomach as its own organ. If you took the stomach out of the human body, not only would the stomach die, the body would die. Whereas the West kind of view life, of course, they would go, oh, well, you can take your stomach out. Well, actually, probably some people would argue that these days. It's more like of a house sort of a way of inventing life. Like you build up your house, you can add another room over here. If you want to upskill yourself over there, you can acquire different things. And the back of the house isn't dependent on the front of the house. You can change that if you want. I would say that's kind of the evolution that my story arc of like how my perspective has changed is once I grew up in the narrative of having that like West point of view. And I'm not saying it's the wrong point of view. It's great to have multiple different views of life. Like the truth depends on where you're looking at it from. And so I would say that my return back to thinking of, okay, well, how can we grow better food? How can I write and publish a book? How can I get involved in technology in a way that it's synergistic with all of that? It's just the culmination of acquiring different viewpoints of the world, rather than the narrative that kind of gets force-fed to you through school and your social interactions and whatnot.
With the Eastern philosophy, what do you credit to getting you started on the Eastern philosophy path?
Probably all the works by Alan Watts, if you ever heard of him. So, and also like the Book of Five Rings, just a bunch of different books. I'm trying to remember the Tao Te Ching, of course. So Alan Watts is probably one of the major ones because he was a philosopher in I think the 60s, 70s, very prolific, had lots of talks. You probably heard snippets of his talks online. But he was also fluent in Chinese and Japanese and, not only the language, but the calligraphy. So he could translate the doctrines into Western terminology. And a lot of his books are basically introducing Eastern viewpoints from a Western perspective. So it's you might hear like the Taoists sort of like what are they called, koans or problems that they say, things like how do you look at this tree straight, and it's like a philosophical like mind puzzle to sort of like get you to think of the way of. Well, that's more Zen. So again, I'm a novice to these things, but they just excite me. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I could read that. And then I now look at the world in a totally different perspective. Like I've acquired a different lens to look on things. So I would say, Tao Te Ching, Alan Watts, there's another book called the Yi Jing, which is actually very fascinating from a technological standpoint because the Yi Jing was actually the inspiration for binary code. So binary code is what creates computers. It's what enable us to do now. Essentially, everything that we're doing now is just some microprocessor transistor flipping 0 or 1 times billions and trillions. The Yi Jing is the Chinese, or not Chinese, but just a way of looking at, or Eastern way of looking at, like 64 different ways of saying yes and no. So if you imagine 0 and 1 is just yes or no, on or off. Binary code, the person who like invented binary code took inspiration from the Yi Jing. So that's very fascinating. And that's actually a lot of different things in the technology field come from the artistics or not artistic. Yeah, let's just say non. Their intention wasn't how it ended up being.
Mm. Well, a great example of this, of the East and the West combining to create something crazy, is Steve Jobs and the Autobiography of a Yogi being his favorite book, which is a fascinating concept.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, have you read the Autobiography of a Yogi? I feel like you have stumbled across it.
No, but it sounds like it would be something I never even heard about that. That's awesome.
So he gives away this book called The Autobiography of a Yogi to every single person at his funeral and says, actualize yourself. And that is his final note to everyone. Oh. And so you have Steve Jobs from the West creating the invention that I'm talking to you on and that is widespread in the West. And what does he credit, or what is the most important consumption of his entire life? This mythical figure from the East. And it really makes you think about just everything that we have and the combination of the East and the West and the power of that.
Wow. I'm going to look that up. Autobiography of a Yogi.
Yeah.
I'm going to buy that.
I'm only 60 pages into it currently, but it's fascinating. And do any other combinations of the East and West pop out to you in your mind from your studies?
It depends what you mean by combinations, of like how we're seeing, like seeing things from the East rise up. I think like the whole trend of mindfulness and whatnot, like you could say that's sort of like got an Eastern base. But then again, that's also like mindfulness has arisen sort of like, I feel like, and it's become so like popular because it's the central dogma of it is just to be in the present, like to be now, like here. So that's probably kind of like a coping mechanism of, like when things can get too full on in the West, like we're thinking too forward and too in the past and like just thinking of like, oh wow, like my past influences me now and my, what am I going to do for the future? Like getting depressed about the past and anxious about the future. It's like, well, we need some way. It's a tool, right? It's a tool to deal with, a less than pleasant feeling. So that's probably one. I can't really think of any more off the top of my head. I'm sure they're there somewhere, but, I'm reading a book at the moment by Alan Watts as well. It's called the book on the taboo of knowing who you are, which just kind of sounds like a woo woo title. But when you read it, it's a very eloquent explanation of, or just a inquiry into, why, like the West kind of sees themselves. It's very, you notice a trend in society. We kind of, individualism is just rising like nonstop. So it's like everyone, what could be causing a lot of angst is at the same time, what could be giving us so much freedom as an individual could at the same time similarly be causing so much angst, because you get the highest highs, you get the lowest lows. So if you look at trends of suicide, depression, anxiety, all people on medications and whatnot, that's going up and up and up, but so are individual freedoms. And so for me, I was like, a lot of the values that I kind of have in like terms of like I really like family values. That's why I want to have a big piece of land so we can grow a family, like more traditional style. I'm like, it's funny. Yeah. I'm a tech, full blown tech nerd, but like rooted with, traditional values. So I don't know, like it's interesting to watch. And so when I like read these things and like sort of learn from, different ways of looking at the world, It's like, okay, maybe that's why there is so much kind of angst between the public at the moment, is because we've created this lifestyle that really, yes, on one hand, you get incredible individual freedoms, but you lose the thing that really gives you meaning, and that's a close-knit community, whether that be immediate family or somewhere you go to. For example, I go to the farm and there's like 10 other volunteers, and it's just, the vibe is just everyone just is there to grow good food, and you're just talking and you're just eating together, having a good time. Whereas kind of, especially with the last 2 years, like this pandemic, like the digital world has just been like skyrocketed. Now, like, of course, there's no way we could have this conversation without the technology that we're using. But there is a lot of people out there who could go days, weeks sometimes without interacting in a physical space. Now, what does that do to the human psyche? I have no idea, right? I haven't tried that experiment with myself. It creates a freedom. So this is why I'm sort of like, I see the metaverse and things like that, that like from a tech nerd perspective, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's kind of inevitable, like where things are going in that space. But at the same time, I'm like, nah, it's not for me. Like, I'm interested by it from a nerd point of view, but it's like, I like the real world, man. And you could say, hey, what's the difference between the Earth evolving over billions of years to create a human life form and us evolving over thousands of years to create a digital version of ourselves? So I don't know. It's fun to think about.
It's like almost like the change is happening too fast, right? We've reached this point where it's like technology is moving faster and faster than ever before. The past 10 years have had more change than the previous, than the 10-year period in the that we've lived over the past 10 years has probably had more change than any 10-year span since ever, potentially. And maybe, and so that's just a crazy thing to think about. And the change that has taken place in the last 10 years could have taken a century or could have taken someone's lifetime. And we're witnessing it all in 10 years. And there's this great theory by Tim Urban who believes that the passage of technology increasing is going to happen in shorter and shorter time spans. And we're going to be so profoundly shocked by it. And it's just, I don't know what to make of it. What do you make of it as somebody who spent a lot of time in nature and someone who spent a lot of time in the metaverse or the internet?
Yeah, well, so I totally agree with that sentiment. And I also agree that you can't stop the machine. So like, it's going to keep getting faster and it's going to keep improving. And like we've bought the ticket and now we're taking the ride. On that point,
we didn't consciously choose to buy the ticket, right? Like the ticket would have existed. No one person said, we're going to press this button. I feel like it was the natural result.
Yeah.
And we had no choice in it.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. Well, I feel like it's like, if you look how evolution, the mechanism supposedly works, the theory of evolution is that it works via the mistake. So it tries something, it doesn't work, it goes out. So maybe like technology is just a version of evolution. Like a technology will come out and if it works, it sticks, and then it changes over time to better serve the inventors of such technology. So maybe when the first eye was developed through evolution, and now I'm thinking out loud here, it was magical. Like it was the first visual recognition system that existed. And so the same thing, when the first iPhone came out, it's like, wow, this is a marvel. And now it's like, I've got like 3 iPhones in my house. I've got 4 cameras within my vision. Like And so like when they first came out, that's a huge thing. And so our tool of like technology, yeah, is downstream from evolution. Like we're just reinventing. I can't put it into words. Where technology for us is now, we're just it's the natural cycle of things. It's like evolution has got right up to this point, and it's like that's a biological world. And now it's like, okay, now we're transitioning to like a silicon-based version form of evolution through technology. And so in terms of like things like the metaverse and whatnot, I would say that it kind of already exists in the form of like Minecraft. Like Minecraft, if you ever played Minecraft, or if you ever watched like a young kid play Minecraft, they are literally engulfed in another world already. Like they can create their own world. Like that's, so that's, metaverse has been trialed and tested on a younger generation for the last 10 years since Minecraft's been out. And I would argue as well, I've spent multiple years in a metaverse playing RuneScape, which is an online game where you can create your own character, interact with other characters that are also doing the same thing. You can train up your skills on certain things. You can decorate your house to how you want it to look like. You can form teams of people and go and kill other monsters and whatnot. So it's like that whole idea of like the metaverse has been tried and tested already through video games, and the younger generation, like they love it. So in terms of like when I look at it, I'm like, holy crap, like, and I see those like floating bugs going to like Zoom meetings on in the metaverse, I'm like, fuck that shit. But like some form of that is probably like, this is the way, like it's skeuomorphic, right? Like we've created. And this is probably also another exciting thing about NFTs. We kind of we touched on this before we started recording, but it's when we have a new technology, new in brackets, we kind of map it to existing ways of thinking. So I'm not sure if you ever had like the first version of the iPhone where everything, like the notepad looked like an actual notepad from like the book, actually, like the Books app looked like an actual book. So everything was skeuomorphic design. It was like just basically, let's just take what we do in everyday life and plonk it on this technology, which is kind of the same as what the metaverse video that Mark Zuckerberg posted, which was like they were going to meetings and stuff and metaverse and all that. So it's like it's literally just taking what we do every day and putting it in there versus getting that creative idea and like going, well, what can we do? Who knows? You can't, like, that's the beauty of it. Like, I can't even put it into words because the use cases for it won't even be, like, you can't put them into language now because they don't exist yet. So, yeah, faster and faster, definitely, which is kind of, I like the balance. I like the dichotomy, the polarization between, okay, yes, I want some land, but I also like being a full-blown tech nerd and nerding out on this stuff and writing code for hours on end. So I think that's, for me, that's how I create balance. It's like if I'm sick of the computer, I'm sick of looking at a screen and whatnot, I'll go work in the fields for a bit. And then if I'm sick of working in the fields, my body is really sore, I'll come and use a screen for a bit. So that's my ideal balance, I guess, at the moment.
The Surrender Experiment by Michael Singer. Have you heard of that one?
No, I haven't. Michael Singer.
Wow.
Has he done any other works?
I've given you book reviews. His other book is called The Untethered Soul.
I'm good. Oh, I've heard of that one. Yes. The Surrender Experiment.
The Surrender Experiment,
okay, beautiful,
is one of my favorite books of all time. And
yep.
What is incredible about his story is he is somebody who in 1970 said, I'm going to get back to the land. I am going to sit in this place in the middle of the woods, and I'm going to start meditating. And what ends up happening is the Surrender Experiment is his journey. He ends up coding by a series of crazy events. He ends up creating one of the first medical codes databases for doctors and hospitals. And he ends up as the vice president of a billion-dollar company in WebMD. And the surrender experiment is his journey of surrendering to the flow of life and becoming just more in touch with himself and forgetting what he wants at any given moment and just surrendering. And he perfectly encapsulates the journey of code and nature and combines them. It's an incredible book that reminds me so much of you. And so maybe you did it in a slightly different way where you went first to tech and now you're going back to nature, but it's definitely, it should be one of the next books you read because it's got your name on it. I can't believe that it took me until this point in the conversation. Yeah. Can't believe it took me to this point to realize.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, history rhymes with itself. So there's nothing new under the sun, right? So it's like, That's awesome to hear. Like I've heard of The Untethered Soul, but I haven't heard of that. So I like that. Thank you.
Yeah. So we got you with a couple of different book recommendations, The Autobiography of a Yogi and The Surrender Experiment. And is there anything else you'd like to mention before we get you out of here on your second appearance on the Danny Miranda podcast? Dude, and also like big shout out to you because you believed in me. You believed and gave me the opportunity before I even published a single episode. So really appreciate you. And I'm really grateful for you for giving me that chance and opportunity.
Brother, I could see the spark. I could see the energy. I could feel it. I was like, oh, I know this. I've seen this before. I've felt this in myself. So I was like, I want to cultivate that. I want to see that ember just light into a flame and spread love around the world, which is clearly what you're doing with this. So, thank you. As for if there's anything more, no, that's it. I think we've talked about enough. Anyone who's listening, have fun.
That is the key of all this. Just have fun. Thank you for your appearance. Thank you for coming here. We'll put all your links for everything down below so people can check out your stuff. It's a wild treasure trove of articles, videos, podcasts galore. You're an incredible creator, and I'm grateful for the chance to talk to you once again.
Thanks, Danny.
Hope you enjoyed that episode with Daniel. If you have any questions or thoughts or feedback about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. As always, I'm extremely, extremely grateful for you listening up until this point of the episode. And I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day or night. And I will see you in the next episode.